You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In 1994, three teenagers were falsely accused of the satanic ritual killings of three eight-year-old boys in West Memphis, Arkansas. They came to be known as the West Memphis Three, and Damien Eccles, their alleged ringleader, was sentenced to death. But the trial was marked by missing evidence, false testimonies, and public hysteria. And when the HBO documentary Paradise Lost was first aired in 1996, it brought international attention to the case. And one person who saw it was Laurie Davis, a landscape architect living in New York. She wrote to Mr. Eccles, and over 16 years, they would write thousands of letters and eventually fall in love and get married. They've written a book called Yours for Eternity, A Love Story on Death Row. It's published by Blue Rider Press, and it is my great pleasure to welcome Damien Eccles back to our show, along with Laurie Davis. Hello.
Hi. Hello. Thank you for having us.
Damien, how did you first come to the attention of the police as a suspect in the murders?
I think really what it boils down to is we lived in a very small, hardcore, right-wing, fundamentalist conservative town where I just did not fit in with the local culture and ideology. You know, the clothes I wore, the music I listened to, the books I read, those were actually the things they presented against me at the trial. You know, for example, the evidence that they brought up at the trial was the fact that I read Stephen King novels, that I listened to Metallica albums and owned black T-shirts.
Like you were the only person in America.
Exactly. In that community, though, that was all they had to do in order to sentence me to death.
What was the mood like in West Memphis during the investigation?
Oh, it was
before you were arrested.
It was angry, suspicious. You know, you couldn't go anywhere where people weren't talking about this. You know, it was nothing really happens in a small town like that. So whenever this did happen, it was sort of all consuming. It was sort of like a bomb went off in that community and disrupted everything.
Laurie, in one of your early letters, you described to Damien the audience's disbelief after they saw Paradise Lost. What happened?
It was overwhelming, I think, for the whole audience. And it was
this
one
is
of
with a question and answer
the
afterwards.
Q&A. Right. It was one of the, I think it was the second screening of Paradise Lost. And Joe Berlinger and Bruce Snofsky were there and were able to, but there were so many questions. They had, I mean, this was a late screening, 9 o'clock on a Monday night. It was raining outside, and the audience, it was 12 o'clock, and they had to be ushered, they had to be forced out of the theater. So everyone was just, you know, we were just flabbergasted at what we had just seen and so many questions.
Damien, who were the other two teenagers in the West Memphis Three? And I wondered why, were you even interested in satanic things? Why was Satanism used as a motive?
I think that it was during a time period in America that they now, it was a something that was going on that they now call satanic panic. There was a time period when you had even really high-profile journalists like Oprah Winfrey and Geraldo Rivera. They were doing all these shows and having all these so-called experts in who were testifying to things like how there was this huge underground satanic conspiracy and thousands of people were being sacrificed every year.
Babies were being roasted in
exactly.
basements.
Yes, and people gobbled this up. You know, everyone believed it for some reason for a short period of time. Eventually, people started to question it and, you know, it was all dismissed. But right at the heart of it is when these crimes happened that I was convicted of, and that's what brought all the satanic aspect in.
Laurie, you write that after seeing Paradise Lost, you felt you understood Damien. And you say that's because you were also a bit of an outsider when you were growing up?
I was also raised in the South in West Virginia, grew up in a fundamentalist Christian home, but I was always questioning and I was a bit of a rebel and a bit of an outcast. I can't say that I completely understood what he was up against or what he had endured, but I had an idea of somewhat.
But you also listened to Metallica?
I listened to Culture Club.
Damien, Jesse Miskelly was a minor when he was questioned, and although he'd been informed of his Miranda rights, he later claimed he didn't fully understand them, and then 8 months later, he continually ignored the advice of his lawyer and went on to detail how the three 8-year-old boys had been abused and murdered. Why do you think he did that?
Well, we're talking about someone who had an IQ of between 68 and 70.
He hung out with the two of you?
No. He lived close to our neighborhood, but, I mean, we're talking about someone who was literally mentally handicapped, so it wasn't like he was a close friend of either of ours, but we knew who he was. And in essence, that's what made him so vulnerable to the police. They picked him up, and over a period, the first time of a period of somewhere between 12 to 14 hours, they tortured a confession out of him.
But that was ruled inadmissible at the trial.
Exactly. It was ruled inadmissible, but still it was introduced into the jury room where we had no chance to combat it or point out the fact that the whole thing was completely inaccurate or anything else.
How was it introduced to the jury room? Isn't that illegal?
The jury foreman, yes, it was completely illegal. That was one of the reasons the court finally ruled that there was going to be a new hearing in our case, because the jury foreman introduced it into the jury room even though it had been ruled inadmissible.
Laurie, you say that you couldn't sleep after you saw Paradise Lost. Had you ever written a letter to someone in prison before?
No, I'd never done anything like that.
So what led you to do it here? Did you just take him with Damien?
I was. I had felt, and it's hard to explain when you feel a connection to someone, and I'd never been moved to do anything like that in my life, to reach out to someone like that. But I just, maybe it was because of the way that I grew up and all of that, but felt a real kinship to him.
Were you afraid that he might not write back?
I was. I just, in the first letter, which I actually don't think is in the book, my first letter to him isn't, it's been lost, but in my first letter I offer him help.
And in what way?
Any way he needed it. I just thought if he needed books and if he needed, if I could help him in some way.
Was Laurie the only one writing to you, Damon?
No. After the first Paradise Lost documentary came out especially, I was receiving letters from people all over the world, but there was something different about Laurie's. I knew from the very first letters that I received from her, this is someone completely and absolutely unlike anyone I've ever known before.
You had no idea that what was going to finally happen.
No idea at all.
Or that you'd even meet her.
Exactly.
Why was the possibility that two drug abusers who'd fled to California, Chris Morgan and Brian Holland, ruled inadmissible at your trial?
I think it was just because they were so dead set on convicting us. Literally, the prosecutor, the judge, and the jury, they saw this trial as nothing more than a formality that they needed to get through in order to sentence me to death. They didn't want anything interfering with that in any way. So
they just ignored the fact that the California police said, we have these guys.
Exactly.
They actually admitted to it, although they then have changed their testimony.
The judge says, that doesn't matter. Those guys aren't on trial here. You are.
The judge allowed the prosecutor to say that you have no soul.
Exactly.
That was okay?
Yes. They said, the things I was talking about a while ago, the Stephen King books, the Metallica albums, they said these things are not only proof that I'm a satanic murderer, but they're also proof that I have no soul. And the judge allowed that in the courtroom.
How did Joe Berlinger and Bruce Sinofsky first approach you about making Paradise Lost?
I don't remember exactly. I remember doing it. I remember filming it. And I remember them telling me that they had learned about the case from an article in a paper here in New York and that they assumed that we were guilty. And then they show up to film this trial thinking they're going to film an open and shut case. And they realize, oh, something else entirely is going on here.
And the West Memphis Police Department gave them a lot of access because they felt that a film would confirm your guilt.
Yes, the same way with the judge. It was really remarkable that the judge even said, okay, sure, come into the courtroom and set up your camera and film the trial. If not for them doing that, I would be dead right now.
Because if there hadn't been filming, you think the state would have felt okay to just have you executed?
Oh, yeah. I always tell people that this case is nothing out of the ordinary. It happens all the time. The only thing that made this case exceptional was the fact that we got the entire thing on film. Most people aren't that lucky.
Were you able to see Paradise Lost while you were in prison?
No. I tried to watch it one time. I made it about maybe 20 minutes into it, and it was one of the only thing I can compare it to is whenever you hear stories about, like, Vietnam vets having flashbacks. It was too much. I can understand why it had such a profound impact on people, because when I started to watch it, it felt like being there in the courtroom again, and it was just too much, and I couldn't.
It could have been like a PTSD experience.
That's exactly what it was, yeah.
My guests are Damian Eccles and Laurie Davis. They have put together a joint memoir called Yours for Eternity, a love story on death row. Laurie, early on you say that you developed letter writing rituals. What were they?
Sometimes I would write messages under the stamps.
Under the stamps so that the officials would not see them?
It wasn't so much that. It was more a game that I was playing with Damian. I would tell him stories under the stamps. And actually,
and did he know to look for them?
He didn't.
Not for a long time.
He eventually a stamp came off or something, and he saw, and then he went back through and read the story that I had written. I would use a particular type of ink. I used pen and ink, and I'd use sepia ink only on his letters. I'd open them from the, you know, they're open them only from the right side. I'd always kiss the back of an envelope and leave a faint
trace. The stamp had to be on upside down.
Yeah, the stamp had to be upside down. There were lots of work went into these letters.
So there was already love developing before you ever met or you ever knew whether this was a person you might want to love.
Oh, we corresponded so much before we actually met in person that we had fallen in love with each other's minds.
There's also, Damian, a moon water ritual. What was that?
Yeah, well, you know, I kind of compare it to brain damage. You know, when part of the brain is damaged, a lot of times other parts will try to form new connections to compensate for the damaged parts. And that's what we sort of had to do with our relationship to make up for the things that we didn't have access to, things most people take for granted. So we would do things like, we started this ritual we called making moon water, where every month, the night of the full moon, we would put a container of water in the window so that the moon's reflection would shine in it. And then every single night at the same time for the rest of the month, both of us would take a sip out of that container at the same time every night so that we would know at that moment, in that time period, we're both together doing the same thing.
You say that you weren't alive until you arrived on death row. Had you felt dead before then?
I think in a way I had, even at that young of an age, you know, I was only 18 when I was arrested. I think I'd already started to feel that people are sort of interchangeable, you know. I had started to feel sort of jaded with human relationships in general, just because of the world that I came from there. You know, it's so downtrodden and everybody loses hope, and most people, you know, look like their grandparents by the time they're 30, and I had assumed that's the whole world. And then when I met Laurie, I realized, oh, that's not the whole world. There is whole other universes out there.
Did you have any hope that your case might be overturned, or did you just assume you were going to be there until you were executed or stuck for the rest of your life?
You know, I never put specifics on it, like that the case would be overturned, but I always felt that somehow, some way, things would work out okay. We really did not allow ourselves to accept anything else.
And Laurie, one of the most striking things about your letters is you never ask him if he's guilty.
Well, after seeing the film, I did some research. The internet was fledgling at that time in 1996. So I went to a library and I looked at microfiche and did as much investigation as I could. But instinctually, after seeing the film, I felt he was innocent. After I got to know him, I knew he was. And so I didn't feel the need to ask him.
Damian, you say that looking back through the letters is like walking through a haunted house.
It is. You
kept them all. Or almost all of them.
Laurie had to keep them for me because I wasn't allowed to keep them in the prison. There were probably, when we got ready to compile this book, there were about 5,000 letters. They actually weighed 120 pounds. And, you know, you can't put together a 120-pound book. So we had to, you know, take a lot of them out. But it is like coming across a journal that you wrote 20 years ago and having to look at yourself, you know, the way you were back then and forced to see the way you've changed and grown. And it can be kind of embarrassing sometimes.
How did some of the letters wind up on eBay?
I have no idea. No earthly idea. Probably just collectors or something.
A prison official might have taken one.
Could have been anything.
What was normal life like on death row? What was a typical day?
You know, it's almost like there is no typical day. I read a description one time that described it perfectly. They said it's the horror of it is that nothing ever happens, but there's this constant possibility that anything can happen at any second. You live in fear 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
And you write that you try to keep some of the more violent aspects of death row hidden from Laurie.
Yeah, I think the reason for that is because, you know, when you're in a situation like we were in, if she knew how bad my living conditions were, if she knew how brutal, how sadistic, how violent that I was being treated by the guards, by the administration, then it would have been like forcing her to sit there and watch that happen without there being anything she could possibly do about it. And that's just a kind of torture in and of itself.
Were you alone in your cell?
Yeah.
But how much time were you allowed out of the cell?
The last almost 10 years that I was there, you're not allowed out ever. They say that I was in a super maximum security
prison. So this is kind of like solitary confinement.
That's what it was. Almost the last decade that I was in prison was in solitary confinement, in a super maximum security prison.
Which many people feel causes serious emotional damage.
It causes outright insanity. Yeah.
So, and you do feel you have PTSD?
Oh, extreme. So? Yeah. When I first got out, for the first year that I was out, I was in such a state of shock and trauma that I needed someone with – I was almost like an invalid. You know, I needed someone with me all the time. I've been out about 3 years now, and it's gotten a lot easier, but I still have a lot of issues, yeah.
Laurie, when he was writing to you, did you suspect he wasn't telling you everything, that he was protecting you from some of the things he was experiencing?
In the beginning, for the first year or so, I was so caught up in learning about him and writing and just how amazing this world we had created was that I didn't think about it. And that's how well he did at hiding it. So no, I didn't suspect.
How did you tell people your boyfriend was awaiting execution on death row?
I mostly didn't. I kept that to myself.
You had no friends who were concerned for you?
A couple of very close friends that I told, but they were respectful enough to, and they knew that I was hard-headed enough that I'm sure that they were concerned, but they didn't let on, and I waited 4 years before I told my family.
And you must have known that there was a good chance he'd never get out of prison.
I never allowed that into my mind. I from the very beginning, I didn't think that much. I wasn't working on his case until 1998, but even then, I didn't allow that possibility.
Then you met Damien. Laurie visited you in prison.
Mm-hmm.
Did you feel I'm assuming you felt a very strong emotional attachment based on the fact you'd written all those letters, but at the same time, you couldn't even touch each other.
Exactly. We were together for, I think, 4 years before we ever touched. We did not touch for the first time until the day we were married.
Wow. But you were still in prison when you were married.
I was.
They let you at least touch each other?
At the wedding ceremony, yes. Yes, they did, finally.
Laurie, tell us about the rookie mistake you made when you first visited Damien. You did something that you learned from that experience, and you're not remembering.
I'm thinking about a lot of mistakes that I made when I visited Damien.
You said you weren't emotionally prepared.
Oh, the first time I wasn't. I thought you can fly into, you know, I was living here in New York. I flew in the night before, thought I could get up in the early morning, go visit him, and then fly back to New York. That's what New Yorkers do. We do what we have to do. We take care use your time wisely. And I was not emotionally prepared because going into a prison is difficult. And it really affected me emotionally to the point where I was undone afterward.
So you flew back.
I flew back that evening. And even afterward, I mean, I was in such a state of emotional despair. I remember being in a parking lot and I hadn't eaten, I hadn't slept well, I was emotionally distraught, and there was a moment when I even, you know, kind of, you know, passed out a little bit. I didn't fully, but I lost it, and I realized I can't do this. This is too difficult to try to think you can just fly in and fly out.
So is that why you decided eventually to move closer to the prison?
As our relationship became stronger, and then there was a time that I realized it wasn't just going to be this love relationship between us, I needed to try to get him out of prison. So I knew in order to do that, to begin working on his case, I was going to have to be closer to him.
Could the two of you talk on the phone?
Yes, and it was very expensive.
And then you decided to get married. Mm-hmm. How do you get married on death row?
Well, there's always, you know, procedure after procedure that you have to go through, lots of paperwork.
But you come from a conservative Christian family, you said.
I did.
How did your family react?
They didn't have a whole lot of time, just because I told them about 2 months before we were getting married. But, I think they needed some time to accept it. But we went ahead with the ceremony, and we invited six of our friends. And Damien and I were both studying Buddhism at the time and practicing meditation, so we had a Buddhist ceremony.
And you got married in prison, obviously.
We did.
Damien, at times in your letters, you bicker over trivial things like most couples do. But the bigger thing was that you were stuck in prison for 18 years. Mm-hmm. Judge David Burnett denied your appeals. Why do you think he did that, despite the fact that so many other people were convinced that you were not guilty?
I think it was just because we had so much to cover up. You know, we have this idea that judges and prosecutors and attorney generals, they have these jobs because they're somehow moral people looking out for society. Most people don't realize they're politicians, you know, just like senators, just like congressmen. Their number one priority is winning that next election.
Well, he even postponed a run for state senate to preside over the appeals.
He wanted to make sure that the truth did not come out in any way he could, because if he had to admit that he had a part in sentencing an innocent man to death and allowing a murderer to walk the streets for 20 years, he was not going to win that next election.
There was DNA evidence.
He didn't care. He said that doesn't matter. He said, this case is over. It's closed. We not only had DNA evidence, but we had three eyewitnesses come forward who put the man the DNA matched with all three of the victims within an hour of the time they were murdered. He still said, doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. And, of course, you appeal, don't you?
That was what finally got the higher courts to rule that there's going to be a new hearing.
Although you never got out on a totally not guilty thing.
No.
There was a special, a rarely used plea arrangement known as an Alford plea.
Yes. At first, they offered us a guilty plea. And, you know, we said, no, we're not taking a guilty plea. We're not going to say we did something we didn't do. So then they come forward with this thing called an Alford plea. And what it means is you get to legally maintain your innocence while accepting a guilty plea at the same time. And what that does, it makes no sense whatsoever, but it allows the state to not be held responsible for what they've done.
But you still wind up with a prison record.
You do.
It's not the same thing
exactly.
As if you had been totally exonerated.
As of right now, the state of Arkansas still has never had an exoneration. They still maintain that they have never so much as sentenced an innocent person to prison.
Do you know if the police are investigating any of the leads in the murder?
No, they won't. We were told by the prosecutor that they would look over whatever evidence we could bring to them and that they would, you know, take it into consideration and all this sort of thing. But, of course, you know, nothing happened.
One of the other three, Jason Baldwin, didn't want to take the Alford plea because he felt that he wasn't guilty and he would rather stay in prison?
Yeah, that's pretty much what it came down to. He thought that that he had some chance of somehow, some way in the future coming out of this with these politicians admitting that they had sent him to prison for something he didn't do.
If somebody came along and said, you know, this has been weighing on me, I killed those three boys, would that change the Alford plea?
Who knows? There's never really been a situation like this before. I'm pretty sure that if that happened, the prosecutor, the attorney general, and the judge would still try to cover it up, but it would be a little harder for him to do it.
Has anyone ever apologized to you?
Never.
Lori, Damien says that he had PTSD. What was it like adjusting to life with him after he got out of death row?
It was difficult. I was approached one morning by his lawyer. I got a call saying Damien may be out of prison in 3 days. And so we didn't have a lot of time to prepare. And both of us kind of just went into shock. It ended up being about 9 days later he got out. But from that moment, we didn't have a lot of time to think about anything, to prepare for anything. And I had no idea what PTSD what the symptoms were, and it was devastating to him and for me as trying to care for him.
People who've been in prison for a long time often feel uncomfortable about going out. Was that a problem? What were some of the things that he did around the house?
Well, sometimes he would stay in bed and want to read or do, but he didn't have that luxury for the first year. We hit the ground running. We had a film that was coming out. He had a book that was coming out. So we were on tour for almost the first year, and that was extremely difficult because flying and traveling around is hard for a person who's suffering in that way.
Damien, are things getting easier?
They are. I mean, I'm still not completely over it, but I can tell things are a lot better than they were before. I talked to another guy who had been on death row for 16 years before finally getting out, and I asked him, I said, how long were you out before you felt normal again? And he said probably 5 years.
The Alford plea doesn't allow you to get money, but I once spoke to the lawyer of somebody who had been given a lot of money for a wrongful conviction, and his family wondered why he insisted on just staying in a room all the time. They said, you got all this money, why don't you go to Europe?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He couldn't imagine doing anything but staying in a room because so much of his life had been spent cooped up in a tight space, and that's how he felt most comfortable.
It's hard sometimes. I can deal with crowds in some situations. Like, I can walk down the streets of Chinatown and it doesn't bother me, but I can't go into a crowded movie theater. You know, even now in New York, I only go to one movie theater, and it's one that's, you know, stuck way off in the corner somewhere, and nobody knows it's there.
So the one that's going to go out of business.
Exactly. I'll go there, and there may be four other people in the entire place, and that's the only one I'll go to and watch a movie.
Well, there are a lot of people around here at WNYC, so I'm really pleased that you were able to get past that and come on our show.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. I've been talking with Damien Eccles and Laurie Davis. Their book, Yours for Eternity, A Love Story on Death Row, published by Blue Rider Press.
Thank you so much.